to give you a recap on the exercise that we did on Thursday, basically, for those of you who weren't here, I gave half the class a 3x5 card and said that they get 30 points to distribute however they want. And they were paired up anonymously with someone else in the classroom, and they could decide how many of the 30 points they wanted to give to the other person. Two-thirds of the class, 8 of the students who had the card, basically wanted to give half to the other student and half to themselves. And then a third of the class wanted to be more generous to themselves and gave themselves extra points. And one student gave themselves the full 30 points. What's interesting then is that means is that one student, randomly selected, got 0 points. And so for me, and how this relates even to today's class, is what do we do about this person? You know, in a sense, this is the middle class, the people with the 15s. Like, you're doing fine. Sure, you would have liked more than 15 points, but you're not complaining about 15. You're going to get by with 15. 15 is fine. These people are kind of like feeling nice that they have extra points, and so they're not really sweating it very much. But then you have this person down here, to no cause of their own, but just the random luck of the draw, they got 0 points. And so do we as a class have any type of social obligation to this person who got 0? Or do you feel like we should have? Like, should we do anything about the 0 or just sort of move on? Any thoughts on how we should respond to the person with the 0? Well, and also this is, in a sense, an exercise of, this could be a distribution of society in general, that you have some people who are doing very well, a lot in the middle, and then a few who are struggling. Some of them are struggling because they didn't show up to class. Like, there's a lot of other 0s that are here, but it's for the people who didn't show up to class. So you got a 0, but that's your own responsibility. Like, you're responsible for that 0. I'm most concerned about this person here, the one who got a 0, even though they showed up to class, but just the random luck of the draw, they didn't get it. And that's sort of when what I think about with regards to social inequality. There's individual explanations for why some people do better than others, like because of work ethic and all these other factors, but then there's some things that just are outside of their control, and they're left at the bottom end of the distribution, and they're in a very vulnerable position. Now, granted, this is just 30 bonus points, so it's not going to make or break their experience in this class, but if this was their social position in society, they would be very vulnerable. Vulnerable in the sense of falling off and not recovering. Or you look at things like homelessness or poverty or incredible sickness or even death. It's those people who are at greatest risk of that. And today's lecture is going to focus on disabilities. And what I find interesting with disabilities, oftentimes, especially if you're born with a disability, it's nothing of your own doing. It was what you were brought into this world with. And so, in a sense, you're at this position of vulnerability in society, and in many regards, at the mercy of how society is going to respond to you. And in the book, it talks about 20% of the population having some sort of disability. I don't think that's the best way to represent it, because there's varying degrees of disability. And so not all disabilities are equal or have the same effect on an individual. And so you have to look at it more like the different types of disabilities and the types of limitations that it places on you. And then the question is, how do we as a society respond to people with disabilities? Do we have a social obligation to people with disabilities? And what I find interesting, there's a way of looking at society's responses to the most vulnerable, and this has been quoted around the world by leaders, is that a measure of a society is how it treats its most vulnerable people. And we treat our most vulnerable in a variety of ways, and especially with regards to physical and mental disabilities, there's a long history of mistreatment of people with disabilities. And I think it's shifting and changing, but it's helpful to know where we've come from. And there's two major categories of disabilities that we're talking about. One is the physical disabilities that a person has, and the other is the mental disabilities. And there's a long history with mental disabilities of insane asylums, was the historically the way that people with mental disabilities were treated in the U.S. was that they were carted off to an insane asylum. And if you watch or read anything about these mental institutes or insane asylums, they're very horrific. And just basically people are written off and they're put into a situation which it even exasperated their mental illness to where beyond a point of any type of recovery or functioning in society. And with people with physical disabilities, one of the examples of sort of the options for these people were to be a part of freak shows. So if you think of like circus performers, but even in modern day, like if you go to San Francisco or New York City, you'll see people with disabilities out on the streets sort of replicating this idea of a freak show, of their physical deformities or physical disabilities are used, they're exploited because of their physical disability and exploited for the gains of others. And one of them is the history of the circus in the U.S. An option for people with disability, physical disabilities, but it was one that really exploited them. We're going to see a clip on it.
In 1914, Mary Ann Bevan, due to financial desperation, declared herself, quote, "the ugliest woman in the world," unquote, and joined the Ringling Brothers Traveling Freak Show. Alongside Bevan typically sat other so-called freaks, most of whom were simply individuals with physical disabilities. The ugliness of Bevan seated beside people with disabilities clearly demonstrated that for these showmen and their audiences, ugliness and disability were interchangeable. One of the first to make it big in American freak shows was the famous P.T. Barnum. Later a partner in the creation of Barnum and Bailey's Circus Act, P.T. Barnum's act exemplified the ideology that such afflictions as ethnicity, appearance, or disability were similarly negative traits that warranted exploitation and the labeling of otherness. Showmen like P.T. Barnum took advantage of society's tendency to gawk at what it finds unusual. By exploiting this, showmen exacerbated the societal notion that disability was something to be gawked at. Instead of appreciating differences, freak shows mock, disrespect, and exploit differences for financial gain. In the history of disability rights, freak shows represent only one of the many atrocities that have been visited on people with disabilities. These freaks, like all people with disabilities, were human beings. Disability is not a barrier to anyone living a functional and happy life. These barriers are a result of societal structures and create a world in which disability becomes otherness. Freak shows exploited this otherness for decades in America, highlighting and ostracizing those who are different from perceived norms.
What I find interesting in this particular video is the association with ugliness, disability, and racial minorities, of how this idea of there's categories of how we look at people and things that get associated with each other. And so when you think of disability and ugliness, it's one where the person is just automatically put at a disadvantage and sort of categorized into a group where they're set to not be able to be a mainstream part of society. And so a lot of the topic of managing diversity in terms of disability is how do you make accommodations for people to help them become a fully functioning member of society. And I thought I'd start by just having you think about, a lot of you in your memos mentioned knowing someone that had a mental or physical disability. And what I want you to do is turn to a person next to you and share about someone that you knew growing up or that you know here at IU that has a significant mental or physical disability and just what you've learned through interacting with them, whether it be positive or negative. Just someone in your life that you know that has a significant mental or physical disability. But does anyone have a particular experience where it stood out to you in a way that you're like, wow, you know, it wasn't until I met this person that my eyes were open to the realities of living with a disability. Anyone have like a specific experience like that? Yeah.
I had a pretty cool one. Like I was telling them, my girlfriend's a cheerleading coach at one of the high schools in town. And there's a girl on the team that I guess she has some type of heart murmur or problem, and she has seizures every once in a while. So they have this dog that can, like, sense that kind of thing that's with her everywhere. It's like a service dog kind of thing. And I just thought it'd be neat to, because she looks perfectly normal.
Uh-huh.
Once in a while, she has these life-threatening seizures.
And the dog is there to be able to let people know.
To kind of, like, help her, and then again, I guess it alerts people.
Uh-huh.
It, like, makes a noise or some barks or something.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things of having an animal assistant, like oftentimes for people who are blind or other reasons need a seeing eye dog, or in this situation for other reasons, what's interesting is there are a lot of cases of restaurants or businesses that say pets not allowed, and the person will want to walk in and have their pet, and the owner or the maitre d' or whatever will say, oh, you can't bring the dog in, and the person's like, well, I need my dog, and they're like, I'm sorry, no dogs. And there's this standoff, and this is part of what ADA is about, is allowing access for people who have animal assistance, letting them in. But most people don't, or a lot of people don't know about these laws, and so they're caught in the moment, and they're thinking, well, my boss doesn't want me to have pets in here, and I won't be doing my job if I let the pet in, but then I'm also breaking the law if I don't let the pet in. And part of it is just simply a lack of awareness that, you know, most people wouldn't know that, you know, this, you know, they might know, oh, a seeing eye dog, but they wouldn't know, oh, this is for someone who has seizures. And then that means every time she goes into a social situation, she needs to pull out her verification that this dog is for medical assistance and the dog needs to come with me wherever I go. What I want to do is list out as many physical disabilities that you can think of, just in your own experience or what you're aware of or what you see. What are just the different physical disabilities that you're aware of? And we're just going to make a list, because I think it's helpful to simply know what are all these disabilities that we're talking about and what's the range of disabilities.
Missing a limb.
Okay. What other physical ones?
Like in a wheelchair.
Okay.
Paraplegic or quadriplegic.
Okay.
Being blind or deaf.
I remember that what disease is, but it's like where your blood doesn't clot after you bleed.
Yeah. Does anyone know?
Is it sickle cell anemia?
So we'll say sickle cell and non-blood clotting. You're talking about, like, if a person gets cut or injured, they're in serious medical situation where they need immediate medical attention.
Maybe allergies or being allergic to something.
Okay. So one big one is peanut allergies. So where you have an anaphylactic reaction. This is a huge one. Almost every classroom is a nut-free zone now, because there's one child who has a significant peanut allergy. And so then the accommodation that needs to be made is every other kid in the class can't bring peanuts into the classroom during snack time. And this is mainly for younger kids, because they're less able to control what they're exposed to. But in a sense, as a parent, I'm confronted with this inconvenience, because I like to make my kids peanut butter. It's a quick thing to make in the morning. But now I have to change my routine to make accommodations for the one student who has a peanut allergy, where it's a life-threatening peanut allergy. So it's an accommodation just in my everyday life for someone's disability of sorts. What other physical disabilities are you aware of? Down syndrome, cerebral palsy. And then if we think of mental disabilities, what ones come to mind? Like, what are different mental disabilities that people live with?
Autism and Asperger's.
And this is one, autism is one that's the rates of autism diagnoses are just continuing to grow and grow. It's interesting that awareness of disabilities is growing. Part of it was they didn't know, there was no way to diagnose it, or they didn't have a diagnosis for it. And so then, now when they've been able to identify what it is, then they can begin to diagnose it. But there's an interesting study with autism that was done. They found that the greatest growth in the number of autism cases was amongst the high SES population. So they did a statewide study in California just to map out the occurrences of autism diagnoses, and what they found was that the highest proportion of autism diagnoses happened in the highest SES neighborhoods throughout California. And so part of it was, the explanation was, well, there can't be a correlation between wealth and autism, like, because autism is a neurological thing and it doesn't discriminate based on how much money you have in your savings account. So what the explanation was is that wealthier people were more inclined to go to an autism specialist and have their kid be tested, and the more you test for someone, greater likelihood of having positive responses. And so it's not necessarily, what it's saying is that there might be an overdiagnosis of autism cases, or there's a spectrum of autism to where maybe a lot of people have it, but only the people who have a lot of money to go in and get their kid tested will it be discovered that they have autism. So even though autism and wealth are not directly connected, there is an association because of the access to resources that wealthy parents, more wealthy parents have than less wealthy parents. ADD, so attention deficit disorder. What other mental disabilities can you guys think of?
Alzheimer's.
Schizophrenia.
Depression.
Bipolar. OCD.
Dementia.
Anxiety.
So what's interesting is, how does something get classified as a disability? And I don't actually know the specifics of it, but different diagnoses get put into the list of things that are covered by the ADA, and other things are removed from the list. And it's really, I think, helpful to know what things fall under the umbrella of things that are protected by the ADA and what things are not protected. What's most interesting with this is a lot of the physical disabilities are visible, like you can see them, and so when you see someone in a wheelchair, you know that they have a physical disability. But whereas with a lot of the mental disabilities, they're invisible, you can't see them. You don't know that the person has them, and then the person can either choose to self-disclose or not. But then there are even some physical disabilities where it's unclear whether the person, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know that someone is deaf until you might see like a hearing aid or something that would signal to you. But like at first appearance, you wouldn't know. And the other thing with disabilities is that some people are born with these disabilities, and so they've had them their whole life. So if you've been blind your whole life, that's the only reality that you know. But then there's people who have the disability come on later on in life. You know, I have a friend, she had cancer in her eye, and so she lost her eye. She lost her ability to see in one eye. And it's been very traumatic for her, because just the everyday things that we take for granted, she has to like do a double take with. Like her peripheral vision and driving is no longer as strong as it used to be. And she's super scared of losing her other eye. You know, in a sense, if you think about it, you have 2 ears, 2 eyes, and so you take them for granted. But when you lose one of them, then you're like, oh my goodness, if I lose my other eye, I will be completely blind. And a lot of people, the people who are advocates for disability rights, oftentimes are people who became disabled later on in life. And so if you're someone sitting in this room and you don't have any disabilities, it's harder to be sympathetic for people with disabilities, of making accommodations for them. And it isn't until you've been living fully able-bodied life and then become disabled that you recognize, wow, it's really hard. Whereas if you've always been disabled, you sort of, that's all you know, you don't have a comparison. You know it's hard, but you don't know how hard it is. And so it's the people who have shifted from being fully able to being disabled. And one significant example I have is a friend of mine in college. She was a star athlete. She played on the soccer team, and she was a surfer. And she graduated from college and was in medical school. And while she was in medical school, one day she went out body surfing. She was in school in California. She went body surfing, and if any of you know about riptides, she was surfing, and one of the tides came in and just slammed her to the bottom of the ocean. And she said it felt like 10 guys were just threw her down onto the bottom of the ocean, and instantly it broke her neck. And she actually floated in. She was complete. She couldn't move. She was still cognizant and could think and understand, but she's like, it was as if someone had just wrapped her entire body and just were keeping her underwater. She got out of the water, but she was fully paralyzed from the neck down. And she was in medical school, and one of the challenges she faced was, how do I finish medical school as a quadriplegic? And the university made a lot of accommodations for her to make it possible. And she actually has since regained some mobility in her fingers and in different capacities, very, very limited. But now she's a full doctor, and her specialty is in spinal cord injury. What makes her significant in this field, and by having her as a doctor with people with spinal cord injuries, is she's living that experience. And so she's a much, much, much more effective doctor, because there was accommodations made to help her succeed and thrive in becoming a doctor, so that now that she is a doctor, she's a very effective doctor at what she does. And she made a comment about the university where she was going, and it was the number one medical school in rehab. And the way that she recounts the story is, she was in her wheelchair and was going off the sidewalk, but there was no ramp on that particular sidewalk, and so she was trying to, in a sense, jump the curb, and she didn't make it. She went over the curb and just fell out of her wheelchair. And once you fall out of your wheelchair, you're kind of stranded. And she looks up and she sees this nice big sign that says, number one in rehab. And she's just like, you can say certain things about being very accommodating and stuff, but on the day-to-day experience, as a person with disabilities, you confront these things. I remember another instance this was in North Carolina, one time where it snowed, there was a student in a wheelchair, and because the sidewalks were icy and the way that the doors were worked, there was only one handicap access into the building, and that door was frozen shut because of ice. And everyone else just sort of went around to the other door and went in. But she couldn't get into her class. And I happened to be walking in when this was happening, and it was like, it dawned on me how I take it for granted different simple things like accessing a building. And if you can't access the building, you can't participate. Like, if this is the classroom and everyone else got in fine, but the one entrance that this student had available to them wasn't open, and no one was sort of rushing to get that door open because they just didn't know. They're like, well, the four other doors work. Like, why do we have to worry about this one door? But that happened to be the handicap access door. So then the question is, to what extent should public institutions be required to make accommodations for people with disabilities, physical disabilities or mental disabilities? And a lot of the ADA covers that, of saying that, you know, let's make it accessible to all people. The other question within that is, should private organizations be required to make accommodations? And it's, again, the same theme. I mean, almost throughout the entire class, the question has been, should the government mandate or require private businesses to make accommodations for diversity, and in this case, for people with disabilities? And some of you in the book mentioned, gosh, a lot of these accommodations cost basically nothing. You know, it's like a few hundred dollars to put in a ramp or things like that. That's true. But also, there's other accommodations like putting in an elevator system. If you're a landlord of an apartment building, should a requirement to put in, you know, let's say it's a three-story apartment building, should you be required to put in an elevator so that someone who has physical disabilities could get up, could rent the apartment in the third floor? Or there's a litany of other different accommodations that businesses could be required to make. And you could say, well, gosh, it's only, you know, we have this one person with the zero. It's a very small percentage of the population. Should we really need to make accommodations for people when it's such a small portion of the population? So if you're someone who would say, you know, what the ADA is doing and requiring businesses to make accommodations, I want you to come up here, come up to this end. If you're someone where you're like, this just seems excessive and it seems costly and it's only a small percentage of the population, and I don't, you know, I think businesses should be free to decide whatever they want to do, and if they want to make their place accommodating to people with disabilities, it's their choice. So if you're more of the perspective that it's leave it up to the businesses, and if they want to make accommodations, they can, but they shouldn't be required to go down to that end. You guys surprised me. I always think like different reactions, but this is so people farthest on this end. What are some of the reasons why the government should mandate and require businesses to make special accommodations?
I'd like to think of like a good way to explain it in depth as like why I was over there. If this question was like religious freedoms, and then over here when it's physical, like I would really come up with a good list of points. But just like right now, it'd be kind of hard to explain.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like the morally proper thing.
Mm-hmm. But it's very expensive. I mean, if you think about around campus, you know, the different accommodations that are made, there's a lot of money that goes into making these accommodations. Now, I use a public institution, so they have greater obligation to, but a private business who's just struggling to make their business work, and someone says, oh, you got to lay down $10,000 to put this in as well, and they're like, I'm already stretched thin. Other people that would be advocates of requiring businesses to have special accommodations.
I was just thinking, like you said, if you haven't experienced a disability, then it's hard to like relate to that. So,
mm-hmm.
they, like you said, you have the freedom. Should you have the freedom as a business to have to do that? I don't think all businesses would do that,
mm-hmm.
Because they can't really relate, I guess.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, if they're forced to, then it forces them to have to relate.
Mm-hmm.
You're likely gonna have workers who have some disabilities.
Yeah.
So I think it should be required.
Yeah. No, I think it's very hard for me, not having any disabilities, to be sympathetic towards people. Like, I might see someone with disabilities and it'll stand out to me, but I don't live with that person. I don't follow them around campus or follow them through life to actually see what the limitations they face. You know, it's not part of my lived experience, and unless I know someone and walk around with someone, do I realize, oh wow, there's a lot of challenges.
It's hard to relate then.
Yeah. What about the people on this end who would be more advocates of letting businesses decide whether or not they make accommodations?
I mean, I think so, yeah. I mean, not everyone can really get accommodations, but I feel like a lot of people can. Like, the book said, like, 10% of people with disabilities that are, like, the only ones in the workforce, so I feel like those tend to be good to have accommodations for.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's important to apply accommodations for people.
Yeah, one, it's what a lot of people who have disabilities don't need any special accommodations.
Yes.
So it's not really talking about those, but it's the ones who, whether it's someone who's blind or someone who's in a wheelchair or someone who needs any other type of special assistance above and beyond what the other employees need, should the employer be required to make those accommodations?
I mean, if they can handle the work, I feel like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If they're doing just as good as everyone else, then there's no reason not to have those accommodations. So
mm-hmm.
that's how I look at it.
Yeah, and part of it could be like even things like, should buses be wheelchair accessible? Should airplanes be wheelchair accessible? You know, it's a significant cost to those companies to redesign a bus or an airplane so that a person would, and who should pay for it? In a sense, it's either just gets spread out through all the customers, or it's a sunk cost for the business. I mean, I think it isn't until you're actually running a business and confronted with these lawsuits. You know, there's a lot of examples of small businesses that are irate with this law because of the cases, the legal cases that get brought up against them, saying that, you know, you're not meeting ADA regulations. Rand Paul, if you follow any of his politics, he's a libertarian, and his perspective, he's not supportive of the ADA. He's like, this is hurting business. by requiring all businesses to make accommodations for a group of people that's, in a sense, a smaller proportion of the population and doesn't need access to all these different services, making that requirement is hurting businesses, and it's infringing upon their liberties. So it isn't straightforward that, oh yes, ADA is all good and everyone's in supportive of it, and why wouldn't you be? There's a significant portion of the population that has serious issues with it. And a lot of it, oftentimes, is small business owners. And a lot of you might be in that camp where you're running a business or a small business and you're being confronted with ADA regulations. So we can go back to our seats. So when you guys walk around campus, what are some of the things that you notice in terms of accommodations that are made for people with disabilities? What are some of the things that you...
Just like when you're trying to go into certain doors, they'll have the buttons that automatically open them.
Yeah, the buttons. The door buttons.
I see, like, drivers, too, sometimes.
Drivers. Like in the golf cart type thing? Or?
That, and I see, like, wheelchair-accessible vans.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, vans. What other things you guys see?
They provide 2 free CAPS sessions, like the psychological, like you can sit down and talk to a therapist.
Which is called CAPS?
Yeah, it's called CAPS.
Okay. And
you get 2 free sessions.
So everyone gets
2
free sessions. What other things do you see on campus?
I'm just thinking like going up to Wells Library, like you're not forced to take the stairs. That's the quickest way, but there is the side.
Like the ramp.
Yeah, by Jordan.
Yeah.
You don't have to take stairs to get up.
Braille on the elevators. Any other things that just as you walk around?
Some classrooms have wheelchair lifts.
Now my guess is that if we had a student with disabilities in this class, they would be able to list off a lot more. They'd say, oh, that and that and that. And when those things are not operating, I can't get around as much. Even little things that you wouldn't even think of, like door handles. If you look at that door handle, that meets ADA specifications. So it's very easy, much easier to open that door because you just need to push down versus a door knob, which requires greater dexterity. So, but if you don't have a disability where you've lost your ability to turn a knob, you wouldn't recognize it, and you would think, well, what does it matter if the I don't even think about the doors that I go through, I just access them. The other thing is that who is the person who made the university aware of the different accommodations that are needed? It probably wasn't a fully able-bodied person, but it was probably someone with disabilities who's in a planning meeting and a design team meeting and says, actually, I can't, I'm a teacher here and I can't even get into my classroom because the way the doorknob is configured. And if we put in these types of doorknobs, which cost the same but just have a different design, I could get into all the classrooms. And so could all my students. And so what's interesting is when you talk about disabilities and making accommodations within your business, it really is beneficial, in a sense, to have people with disabilities a part of the design team. So when we talk about managing diversity, or in particular leveraging diversity, to be able to make accommodations for all students, and I think about a place like IU where truly IU wants to be a place where all people can be included and all people can be a part of participating in higher education. I mean, a lot of you throughout this course have said, goodness, if a person can't get an education, they're screwed in society. And so what if you have a person with a physical or mental disability and your university system isn't making accommodations or it isn't accessible for people with disabilities? So a lot of times we think about, is the university accessible to people of all races and people of all genders? And you would be outraged if it wasn't, like if there was sort of this door that prevented people of certain races from getting in, we'd tear down that barrier. But what if there's barriers that are preventing people with disabilities from getting in? There should be a similar outrage. If we look at the value of education, and what things are being done or in place that prevent or inhibit people from disabilities who want to get an education but are not able to access it. And so what I want to cover is sort of the American with Disabilities Act, because this was sort of the movement that changed how we view as a society people with disabilities, and really the movement to, across all society, across all of the U.S., make accommodations for people with disabilities. And it was a major, major movement. If you think about the era of circuses and insane asylums, that's the era that they were coming out of, and there's a big social shift to change the way that we relate to people with disabilities. And so this gives a bit of the history of the ADA and how it came to be.
One of the goals of the ADA was to change the way the world perceives disability and then reacts to it. For the first time, the Americans with Disabilities Act enshrined in federal law that disability is a natural part of the human experience and that the world needs to change a little to let us in. The Chicago disability community was very engaged with the passage of the ADA. In fact, Access Living was the Midwest organizing hub. We took our directions from the people inside the Beltway who were working on the draft language. I was the president of our National Council on Independent Living at the time, and we led a march from the Congress to the White House demanding a meeting with the administration. We got it. And that was a watershed moment in getting the administration to move forward on some of its resistance. You have to understand that the disability community had been told we'd never get this done. Here you had a group of ragtag people who couldn't walk, couldn't talk, couldn't see, really creating the most significant piece of civil rights legislation since the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We've made progress in the built environment in a lot of areas, but it's much more difficult to legislate things to change the hearts and minds of people. That work is still far from finished. When we first approached Terry Mazzini at the Chicago Community Trust with the goal of using the anniversary for change, Terry listened to us and then came back and said, "You're not thinking big enough." He understood that we need the paradigm shift that has occurred within the disability community, and frankly within the law, to now be a paradigm shift shared by everybody. And to do that, we needed everybody to be involved.
The American Disabilities Act provides mandatory rules for our society to follow to remove the barriers for people with disabilities.
This historic act is the world's first comprehensive declaration of equality for people with disabilities.
The ADA laid the track for a lot of the programs that are available in the United States. And the opportunities that we have for people with disabilities are much more conducive to helping foster independence for people. MVLE is a nonprofit organization that helps people with disabilities find jobs and achieve independence in their lives.
MVLE, they are giving an opportunity to somebody who's seen as a disabled person, but they're not actually. If you look at Anis, I mean, he's just like any other employee I would have in this building. He's capable of doing everything.
I like this job, pushing the cart. If a customer is coming and I help him, if he tell me I need a help for any big items, any heavy items, I put in the cart and I do it.
Intellectually disabled people are people just like you and I. It's just that they learn at a different pace or in a different way. Well, Walmart has been great, and a lot of the other companies that we have worked with, to give opportunities to folks that are living with disabilities, folks that are living with different abilities.
The customers of that business actually value that business more in their market if they actually have an integrated workforce that includes people with disabilities. The return on investment for a business is that they see that these employees are not just hardworking, but extremely effective.
Just because they look a particular way or sound a particular way doesn't mean that they can't be trained to do the job.
Every man, woman, and child with a disability can now pass through once closed doors into a bright new era of equality, independence, and freedom.
So this is a very recent phenomenon. It's just in the last 25 years that a lot of these changes in laws were made. And there's, in a sense, two options in a society. One is to take people with disabilities and either ignore them and sort of push them off to the side. I mean, when you talk about the insane asylums or the mental institutes of the day, there are these huge hospitals where people are just sent away and sort of push them out of sight, or the people become homeless. You know, the homeless population, the percentages of mental illness amongst people who are homeless is very high because there aren't opportunities for them to get the treatment that they need. And the other option is what the ADA is moving towards, of how do we include these people in society to be self-sufficient members of society. But what that requires is making accommodations for these people. And so then that's the big question, is how much of the accommodations should you make and what are reasonable accommodations? And these accommodations could come at the detriment or the downside for fully able-bodied people. So if you're expending resources to help a certain group of people, that means that other people aren't getting access to as much resources as they could be. But even here at IU, the accommodations that are made, it's very interesting, especially people with mental disabilities. I don't know if it's in the CAPS office or one of the offices where if you have a certain neurological disorder or a mental disability, you can get special accommodations when you're taking tests, when you're taking exams or writing papers, to where you can get additional time or be allowed to take the test in a special environment that would enable you to not be limited by your disability. And so for someone who doesn't suffer from that type of disability, do you feel like, you know, let's just give the example of, in some instances, you can get time and a half to finish your exam. So if, say, everyone's given an hour to do an exam, but students with certain disabilities are given an hour and a half to complete the exam. Are you aware of that, and do you think those type of accommodations should be made to students with different disabilities?
I think absolutely, because not everyone is a great test taker. Maybe they just want to take more time to write their essays and stuff. Like,
mm-hmm.
They need more time to think through their thoughts. So I think, yeah, absolutely.
And so do you need a diagnosable condition to qualify for that? Does that make sense? Like, I get what you're saying, that some people are much better at doing homework than taking tests, like, because they get as much time as they want.
I don't know.
So right now, it needs to be a diagnosable disorder or disability to qualify for that. What are other people, what's your perspective on it?
I'm just wondering, though, if it wasn't like a specific disorder, how would you be able to tell, like, everyone would then come in and say, hey, I need more time, and
mm-hmm.
if it wasn't like a set diagnosed thing.
Sure, yeah. I mean, so, but what if you are a person who doesn't, your disability disorder isn't really diagnosable, but you know that you just don't do well on tests, but if you had an extra half an hour, you could nail it, or maybe not nail it, but... you know, you'd be less anxiety.
I guess they should accommodate them to make it fair if you feel you need more time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason. I mean, you're not cheating, you're just needing more time.
You need more time. Other people? You know, because some of you take the test and you're like, ah, I ran out of time. I didn't get to answer that last question. And then you look over at your neighbor and they're still allowed to be able to sit there because of a particular disability that they have. Does that evoke any type of feeling or response in you? Because you know that you're going to be graded based on the fact that you didn't finish the exam, whereas the person next to you actually had an extra half an hour. Are you okay with that? We have a midterm coming up, so maybe I'll do a little exercise of testing this. I won't. Oh, and the other similar thing that came up was related to this is that international students where English is their second language recently came forward and said, I would like special accommodations. I would like more time to take the exam. Now, that's not necessarily a disability in the mental disability. It's just it's a social liability that you have coming to the U.S. if English isn't your first language. So in the same way, should special accommodations be made to students where English is a second language, should that qualify as something that should be, accommodation should be made for? So again, it's the same type of thing where everyone gets an hour to take the exam, but if English is your second language, we're going to give you an extra half an hour because it takes you longer to read the questions and to formulate your thoughts in English. Is that something that would should fall under this accommodation? You think so?
Yeah.
Why?
If I went somewhere else, I would want that, because if I went to a different country.
Mm-hmm. Sure. But I also know faculty are like, you applied to come here, and this is the expectation, and when you go into the business world, people aren't going to sort of be making special accommodations for you to get up to speed with your language. I mean, that would be the counter argument. Like, you need to get ready and get prepared to perform in a society that's English speaking, per se. I mean, it's just where I think the challenge comes, and maybe you guys aren't aware of this, but you sort of look around and like, there's accommodations being given to different people, and you're like, oh, I didn't get the memo that said I might qualify for an accommodation, or I would like an accommodation. Like, school's hard, and I'm struggling, and I would like accommodations, and why are these people getting accommodations, and what does it all mean? I think it's something it's helpful to be aware of. You know, you might even be in a situation where, like, you're struggling with something, but you haven't really gone to the free services of saying, hey, this is what goes on for me. Is this normal? You know, and to be able to talk to a professional who say, yeah, let's talk some more. You know, whether it be things like depression or anxiety or other things that are debilitating to you in some regard, or even things like passing out or seizures where you learn how to self-manage them, but in reality, you should probably go talk to someone, and in reality, it's probably affecting your performance, and there's services in place to help you in those situations. So I think a lot of the times with the mental disabilities, you can be a person who's sort of carrying this around, and because you've been carrying it around for so long, you think it's normal. And it isn't until you talk to someone and reflect on your experience and say, here's what goes on for me. Is this normal? And for someone to say, very rarely do I see someone with this situation. Like, this is not normal. But it is treatable, or it is something that can be managed in a better way than what's currently being done. In the textbook, it talks about sort of the essential functions of a, you know, when we think about hiring someone with disabilities, it talks about essential functions and marginal functions. And, you know, these are two terms that would be good to be familiar with, is that the essential functions are, can the employee perform these essential functions, then we can, and what accommodations should we make for them to perform the key functions of the job? And then there's other functions, like the marginal functions, that aren't key to the job. And so a lot of times, as an employer, thinking through what are the core essential functions and what are the secondary functions, and distributing the workload based on people's abilities. And I think what stands out to me is a lot of this emphasis on this chapter is about making special accommodations, but I still always sort of see that there's potential for different categories of people to make unique contributions to an organization. It wasn't really talked about as much in this particular chapter, but I think of the example of, like, IU wanting to be more accessible and more accommodating to people with disabilities, if they want to be successful at that, they need to have people within the organization who are helping with the design of these things. But even beyond that, beyond making it more accommodating, there's organizations are tapping into the creativity and the alternative perspective that comes with people with disabilities. And probably the best example would be Google. And they basically have begun to think through the groups of people that they have in their organization and how their unique abilities or disabilities actually add value to Google as an organization. And we're going to look at how Google is integrating people with disabilities and leveraging their differences to advance and help Google excel as an organization.
What would the world look like if everybody were aware of the stereotypes that they have and the biases that they have? When we talk about unconscious bias, we're basically saying our worldview can actually exert an influence beyond our conscious awareness, and it creates ambiguity.
You go to an engineer who's built something extremely innovative, and you say, who do you think your user is? This is where I have the most fun. My name is TV Raman, and I led our work on Android accessibility for 3 years. Write down everything that you think you know about your user with respect to abilities, inabilities, special abilities, disabilities. Almost every assumption that you write down on that whiteboard about this is the user I think I'm building for is questionable. Because our various unconscious biases define the boundaries you're unwilling to expand.
These biases, they're the shortcuts that our brain has created so that we can deal with the information that we process every single day.
Right when we see anyone, whether we think about it or not, we are implicitly, automatically making judgments about how warm and competent that person or thing is.
All humans need to make decisions, and so we fill in the blanks because our brains are wired to do that, and we fill in with things we don't know with, you know, past experience. Oh, you pattern map to someone I think I should hire, so I'm going to hire you versus this person because they didn't map, because I can't fill in the blank because they don't look like me or they're not from my same background, and so I can't see how they're going to make the jump.
Every single person is great at things that you may not expect them to be, but it's really hard for us to see that when we're so powerfully guided by the things we expect to be true in the world.
I grew up surrounded with this conversation about what you can't do and what you won't be able to do. My name's Enrico, and I'm an autistic software engineer. The first time I go through the performance review process, I was asked for 5 strengths. It was the first time that I had ever been prompted to think in that way about myself, and it was really a life-changing moment for me.
When we are working in our day-to-day jobs, we are still making judgments about the people around us, about the resumes we see, about the employees that we're trying to decide, you know, whether to put them on teams or not.
People are very wedded to the idea that they can perceive something objectively, and statistically they're wrong, but it's hard. You become attached to this idea that you can assess something by looking at it.
These subtle assumptions we make about people can have lasting effects on who we're promoting, who we're hiring, who we're putting in leadership positions. We have the responsibility to understand the assumptions that we make and understand the errors that we make.
But it's not just for the collective good. If you take the time to understand more about this, there are things that you can implement for yourself that'll help you develop as a leader and to do your job even better.
It made me realize how often I have a very strong belief that is simply incorrect. When I look at one of these evaluation situations, the first question is, how can I eliminate the sources of potential bias and leave just the data so we can actually make better decisions?
If you're not conscious of the biases that you have, you're just not contributing at the level that you could, and you're not innovating at the level you could. And so your products won't be as good. Your results won't be as good.
When you think outside the box with respect to the assumptions you made about how somebody would use this wonderful thing you built, and when you sort of broaden that perspective as to who you change the world for, you build something even bigger.
When I went to school out in California, it struck me that the large percentage of students with disabilities in the very expansive student with disabilities program, And a lot of times you would ask, well, why aren't there more people with disabilities in the workforce? Well, it starts back with the education, not even just college education, but then in the public schools, and our accommodations being made to help these people be mainstreamed in a part of the educational system and have opportunities to go to college, because then they'll have opportunities to be in the workplace in significant levels of leadership. But if you think about in the past where there's, I'll say, schools that were just a school for the deaf and the blind, which is one of the schools out in California, where they were tracked to be people with disabilities versus tracked to be mainstream, functioning, included members of society. And so when you see this example of Google, it shatters paradigms of what you would think the options are. What are the possibilities for people with disabilities? And I would say there's value added to the organization, especially if your organization is about innovation and entrepreneurship, including people who have a very different way of looking at the world and navigating the world, can add tremendous value to your organization. But I think about it, it goes back to education a lot of times, and our educational institutions making accommodations for students so that they can thrive and then be contributing members of society. Because I go back to the other option, and I think of things like the circus or the insane asylums, where it was, let's push them out of sight or exploit them because of their disability. And so, in many ways, with disabilities, it's part of it is just sort of, when you walk around campus, sort of look at, oh, what are the accommodations that are being made, but more so interacting with students with disabilities and saying, what is it like being on this campus? And, you know, certain people pick warmer climates. Students with disabilities pick places with warmer climates because when it snows, life becomes much more difficult. Or if they're up in Seattle when it rains a lot, it's much more difficult for some students with disabilities to navigate when it's raining. So they actually will pick parts of the country if they have that luxury to go. But then if you're a resident of Indiana and you want to pay in-state tuition, okay, well, I don't have the luxury of choosing a school in Southern California because, you know, I'm just like you. I need my in-state tuition. I need it to be low. So it's thinking through what are the day-to-day decision-making processes that are involved with students with disabilities. So on Thursday, we're going to have a guest lecturer come in and give specific details related to the area of disabilities. And I'm also going to hand out sheets for the exam. Same type of thing where you have concepts that you're going to need to know, and the exam is going to follow that. So you'll want to come Thursday, and we'll go from there.